A new potential Supreme Court justice echoes one from the past.
I clerked for Justice Scalia more than 20 years ago. His judicial philosophy is mine too.
President Trump nominates Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, and the battle over her confirmation begins. Also, new tax revelations about the president paint a different picture than what he campaigned on.
What makes this story so compelling was that it closes the gap between Trump, the billionaire that he appears to be, and Trump, the businessman who owes nearly $1 billion that he really is.
We're going to talk about it today on The Takeaway for Monday, September 28th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to be with you. How RBG came to be an icon is no secret, but she also had some support from her husband, Marty. We're talking spousal support in the era of COVID-19 and hearing your stories on the topic. All right, let's get to it. First, we head to the Supreme Court, where Judge Amy Coney Barrett has been nominated by President Trump as a successor to the open seat left by the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Popular with conservatives, Judge Barrett, who is 48 years old, would be the youngest justice on the Supreme Court bench. She would also be the fifth woman in history to sit on the nation's highest court. Since 2017, Barrett has been serving on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. But she came under intense scrutiny during the confirmation process for that role, in part stemming from her affiliation with the small but vocal Christian community called People of Praise. Here's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein during those hearings back in 2017.
The dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for years in this country.
Joining me now is Christian Farias, a journalist and writer in residence at the Knight First Amendment Institute. Christian, welcome to the show.
Excited to be here.
And Imani Gandhi is a senior editor of law and policy for Rewire News Group and the co-host of the podcast Boom Lawyered. Imani, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Christian, we mentioned at the top that Barrett is a protege of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. How would she fit in ideologically in the current bench?
She would very likely be the most conservative justice on the Supreme Court. I know that people are used to hearing that with Clarence Thomas, with Neil Gorsuch, and even Brett Kavanaugh. But she indeed is extremely conservative, where you see even her own record on the Seventh Circuit. She's willing to go farther than prior Republican appointees on issues such as gender equality, abortion rights, and gun rights. So to see already her staking out very conservative positions, it won't be a surprise if she tacks even to the right of Clarence Thomas, which currently he is the most conservative on the bench.
Imani, we heard an exchange, or at least comments from Senator Dianne Feinstein in Barrett's early confirmation hearing in 2017, mostly because of her affiliation with a group called People of Praise. What are the concerns about her involvement in this group?
Well, the current concerns are primarily that she is a member of a sect of Catholicism that even mainstream Catholics don't adhere to and find a bit of an outlier. And so I think the concern is that she's such a, she's so religious, deeply religious in a way that would affect people and the rights of people. For example, in the upcoming term, there is a case that will decide whether or not federally funded foster agencies can rightfully discriminate against non-Christians and LGBTQ people, meaning that gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans people wouldn't be able to foster children, and neither would Jewish people or Muslim people. And that's the sort of thing that should concern everyone. That's the sort of religious thinking that becomes not about religious freedom, but more about religious imposition on everyone who doesn't hold those hard right-wing beliefs.
Imani, I want to pick up a little bit also on some of her comments that Barrett made during her acceptance of the nomination in the Rose Garden. Interestingly, she praised Ruth Bader Ginsburg for smashing the glass ceiling for women on the Supreme Court. She even credited her own husband for supporting her behind the scenes. What does that tell us about how conservative women may be? And those are generally considered feminist talking points, feminist ideals. Is Barrett playing or towing the line there?
I think that you're going to see a lot of conservatives try to tout Amy Coney Barrett as a conservative feminist whatever that means. I don't think there's such a thing as a conservative feminist. I don't think that you can be a feminist and A, maintain religious beliefs that essentially require you to be subservient in some way to men, and that is what the people of praise believe. And I certainly don't think that you can call yourself a feminist while at the same time stripping other women, other pregnant people, of the right to choose what to do with their own body. So we're going to see a lot of talk about liberal hypocrisy when it comes to feminism. We're going to hear a lot of people who, up until 2 days ago, didn't even like calling themselves feminists or thought feminism was something bad, but because they're very good at picking up on left-wing talking points and sort of repurposing them in order to fit their own ideology, even though conservatism is just really anathema to what feminists stand for, which is equality between the sexes at a base level.
Christian, turning to her judicial record here, Barrett has criticized Chief Justice John Roberts for his opinion that upheld the Affordable Care Act in 2012. As we all know, the court is poised to hear another challenge to the Affordable Care Act this term. Is there any sense on how she could vote? I mean, this is one of the biggest concerns for a lot of Americans right now.
Absolutely. I mean, her record already speaks for itself. Her comments speak for themselves. The American public is going to have a very good idea of the way she thinks along the lines of healthcare, along the lines of gender equality. A lot of issues, as Imani just said, that are before the Supreme Court just now. And the fact that she said these things, all of those will be fair game, both for senators and for the rest of us to parse and to question. But also at a more deeper level, I think people should have a keen understanding of the circumstances under which she received this nomination. This is a presidency that it's already almost toward its end. It came under a cloud. Just over this past weekend, we heard bombshell revelations about the president. And the fact that everything happened so quickly and that Justice Ginsburg hasn't even been buried, I don't think. It's a lot of things that make you think, all right, what's in it for Amy Coney Barrett? And I want to hear what her motivations are for just embracing this presidency, embracing this nomination, and in a sense, pay lip service to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Does she really stand for and believe in the ideals that this justice stood for? And all of that is absolutely appropriate to probe and to examine.
Speaking of the examination, I'm curious here. I mean, we've seen part of President Trump's strategy and the wider GOP strategy writ large has been to focus on the Supreme Court, but also to focus on lower courts and appointing very conservative judges, very young conservative judges to those courts. This feels like it is the perfect manifestation, Christian, of that strategy for President Trump. He appointed Amy 3 years ago. She's now his nominee for the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. I mean, the very fact of her seat on the Seventh Circuit, it happened because Senate Republicans blocked President Obama from nominating a number of people to that very same court who was shorthanded for many years. And she took Amy Coney Barrett took the seat of a black woman whose seat never got filled due to that blockade. And we see Amy just going with the flow of this project, larger project of packing the courts with very young, very ideological people who have made their views clear. There's no question about where they stand on a lot of the issues of the day. So when people hear Amy Coney Barrett at the hearing or in other settings dancing around the question that she cannot talk about issues that might come before the court, well, that's something, but she already has told us how she feels about many of these issues.
Let's talk about that, Imani, because she is going to have to speak to the issue, particularly of Roe v. Wade and more broadly, abortion rights. What do we know about Barrett's position on abortion rights?
Well, we know that she opposes them. We know that she has said that she believes abortion is immoral, and we know that she believes that her faith drives her work as a jurist. So it is because of her faith that she is going to rule whether it's to overturn Roe versus Wade, which is not even something that needs to happen in order for access to be even further decimated than it already is. And I think that that's really a key point that I think people should pay more attention to what she's going to do when it comes to certain laws like trap laws, for example. So this past term, we had the June Medical Services case, which involved whether or not abortion providers have to get these medically unnecessary admitting privileges. And had the court come out the other way, had John Roberts not sided with the liberals, we'd be looking at an abortion landscape in Louisiana where there would be only one clinic. And so across the country, clinics are being decimated by unreasonable regulations, by rules that require them, for example, to retrofit clinics so that they serve as inpatient surgical centers, even if the only type of abortion that particular clinic is providing is medication abortion, and you don't need a surgical center for that sort of abortion care. So, you know, we don't need to overturn Roe to ensure that abortion access is available only for those who can afford it. And I think that that is something that needs to be clear. And I think that folks need to be less concerned about an outright reversal of Roe and more concerned about just the sort of chipping away at access little by little until the legal right to abortion as set forth in Roe doesn't have any meaning.
We are expecting at least a confirmation process that should be starting relatively quickly before an election. Imani, the confirmation process for Brett Kavanaugh was extraordinarily heated. Would you expect a similar hearing for Barrett?
I don't think that it's going to be as heated. I wish that it would be. I wish that there was something that Senate Democrats were willing to do besides urge voters to appeal to their Republican senators or urge senators to have some sort of respect for institutional norms and honor. And we've seen that they don't have that respect. I mean, the hypocrisy of putting this woman on the bench while people are voting right now, right? Democracy is in action. And they held Obama's seat, Scalia's seat, open for 11 months. And so it's very hard to square that circle. But, you know, if you start thinking about the fact that Republicans, this is just a blatant power grab, then it begins to make sense. So the question becomes, how is that going to affect the election? Is there going to be enough of a Democratic backlash so that people will turn out in droves to vote? Or is it going to sort of make Democrats feel like, well, there's nothing we can do, the court's already gone? And so to continue, I think, along this path of apathy that a lot of Democrats are feeling. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see.
I know it's hard to parse all this apart, but what is something that the Democrats could do if they lose the liberal majority for a generation here? We've got just about a minute.
Well, there's a few options on the table on the hearing just to push back and to, I guess, drive the point home. They could appoint a very able female lawyer to question Amy Coney Barrett. Then after that, if she still makes it through, well, all cards are on the table. Chuck Schumer has said that. They could add more seats to the Supreme Court, engage in an expansive just growth of the federal judiciary. And of course, that'll depend on Joe Biden and Senate Democrats winning actually the Senate. So to the extent that Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death energizes voters, I think voters will render the final verdict. And if they give Democrats the mandate to reshape the court, I think they should take that chance and do it.
Christian Farias is a writer in residence at the Knight First Amendment Institute, and Imani Gandhi is senior editor of law and policy for Rewire News Group. Christian, Imani, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In an explosive report, the New York Times got its hands on President Trump's tax returns for the better part of two decades, including his first 2 years as president. The documents filed by the president reveal a pattern of paying little to no federal income tax, claiming huge losses on many of his luxury properties and investments, and a looming potential debt load of more than $400 million that could come due in the next few years. For many working Americans, one eye-popping number could be the $750 in income tax the president paid in 2016 and 2017. At a press conference yesterday, in response, the president not surprisingly called it
fake news, made up fake.
For more on the details about Trump's tax returns, we're joined now by Maya King, politics reporter for Politico. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The biggest eye-popping takeaway, would you say, was what? That the president hasn't paid federal income tax in a couple of years? What would you say?
I think it's actually that statistic that you read a bit earlier, Tanzina, that he's got about $400 million that could come due in the next 4 years. So if he is reelected, we could be looking at the very real possibility of a sitting president being audited, which is something that we've never seen before, of course. And I don't know, I mean, the awkwardness that would create, the kind of dialogue that would create. And then, of course, you know, the way that voters and his supporters would have to think about the fact that they've paid more in taxes than he has.
We are now 36 days out from the 2020 election. Maya, what sort of effect do you expect this could have on the race, if any?
Well, I don't anticipate this having a huge effect on his base because, as we know, anything that this president does with his most ardent supporters, it's not going to move the needle. However, we have a presidential debate now tomorrow night, and this is giving the Biden campaign more than enough fodder to go after President Trump before then. The Biden campaign this morning has already released a new ad about how little this president has paid in income taxes compared to essential workers, teachers, construction workers, other people that the Biden campaign is really trying to add to its coalition. And I think, you know, in this game at the margins, going after people who were independents or on the fence about this president or Biden, this could really be something that shores up support away from the president and towards Joe Biden.
What I found interesting as well is that the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, wrote a note explaining to readers why they decided to publish this now. My sense, and Maya, I'd love to hear your thoughts, is that the Times is attempting at least to avoid any criticism for doing it so close to the election.
I agree. I think that they understood the stakes of this and that they knew what this would be, this September surprise. And I don't fault them at all. I appreciate Dean Baquet's willingness to be open about that process because, of course, also the stakes here are the fact that they didn't want to, you know, out their sources. And so, yeah, there was definitely a lot riding on the release of these tax returns, though I think that Democrats would agree the timing here was really just right.
We mentioned that the president has a lot of debt, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. Much of it could be due very soon. And one thing I found interesting, Maya, was that the New York Times piece says that President Trump may have run for president to shore up his personal brand. What was your take on that?
I think that's one of the more really, frankly, terrifying details of this story, because what that says is this is a president who never intended to really win, or at least never intended to take this thing as seriously as we were, as we in the press were, and as voters were, that this was really, as you said, an attempt to shore up some empty debts. And there's a line in the story high up that I thought really captures the essence of what they're saying, which is ultimately Mr. Trump has been more successful playing a business mogul than being one in real life. And that's really what makes this story so compelling too, is that it closes the gap between Trump, the billionaire that he appears to be, and Trump, the businessman who owes nearly $1 billion that he really is.
Ivanka Trump appears in this report a couple of times. What do we know about how she may have benefited from some of these tax loopholes?
Well, we know that she was brought on as a member of the family to, of course, help with the administration, but that she was also being paid with federal dollars to actually do these jobs, which I think is also very telling and, you know, speaks to a lot of the criticisms that people had of this White House, that it's just, you know, steeped in lots of nepotism. I think that a lot of people have also looked at Ivanka as very much a public-facing, almost ambassador for this White House. But again, it's another sort of detail of this story that there's more to that. And in fact, that she really has played a role in the illegal dealings financially of this president and of this administration.
One of the other things that stood out is the president's properties, many of which include golf courses that he touts regularly, are also in financial straits. And what's interesting is they point out in the report a strategy that the president may have used to lower his tax bill even further by claiming losses from these properties, including golf courses, et cetera. What else do we know about that? I mean, that seems to be par for the course with the president.
Well, I think that this plays into the strategy that this president has employed from the beginning. You know, we understood that this was a president who really was not a very successful businessman, but has made a lot of money, now we know, by claiming losses on these properties and actually reaping the benefits of them. I think that that's something that we'll really want to know more about as the New York Times continues to release more information here. This is a president who also spends a lot of time golfing and playing at Mar-a-Lago and trying to sort of make that almost a White House South. So, you know, it's really, again, very disheartening, but also just when you really start to dig into this story and see all of the different angles here and how much has gone into this president's business dealings and really just, again, the illegality of all of this, it really is jarring.
We will be paying very close attention to this story as it evolves. Maya King is a politics reporter for Politico. Maya, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega. It's The Takeaway, and it's great to be with you. During the pandemic, Americans across the country showed their appreciation for essential workers who kept our communities intact. From nurses to cashiers to teachers, praise has been heaped on those who answered the call, and rightfully so. But there's one class of essential worker that hasn't received a similar spotlight, despite their backbreaking labor. And those are farmers and food service employees who worked grueling hours during the pandemic. Many of them are immigrants who live in the shadows. A new report out today from the Center for Public Integrity and Mother Jones is revealing just how integral these immigrant workers are and how they have been overlooked by the public health response to COVID-19. One of the report's co-authors, Susan Ferris, is with me now, and she's a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The top line here, your report revealed just how pervasive immigrant labor is on the front lines of essential work. What did you find? What are the percentages?
Well, what we found, we identified almost 2 million workers who are frontline workers in food processing and farm work. And we found that 43% were immigrants. And we found that 9 in 10 were Latino.
That's 90% of the workers are Latino.
Of the immigrants, yes.
We also know, Susan, that there have been high rates of infection among Latino and Black populations and Indigenous populations specifically. What were your findings there? Did the report probe into that?
Yes, we did. We overlaid for a map, a national map, we have spikes of COVID in counties. Our map is county by county, and anybody can go look at it and check out what the percentages are in their communities. And so we did find that there was a connection between the two. And I think anecdotally we're seeing this. What is happening, though, is we're not really keeping track of who's getting COVID and who's dying in these communities. What I found in a community in Georgia was a man who died in May. And really, judging from public records, that you can't tell that he was a poultry worker in the community of Hall County, Georgia, and that he died of COVID. In order to establish that, I got a tip from someone there. I had to find his family in Mexico and confirm that. The company that they told me he worked for would not confirm that he even worked there.
Susan, is this because we're talking about an undocumented population of worker who may be afraid to seek health care because they're undocumented, so they're afraid to approach hospitals or doctors? Or is it because the organizations that are hiring them don't want to admit that they have undocumented workers?
You know, I think it's both. In this case of this man, he was actually a U.S. citizen. He was an undocumented worker years ago, but he received amnesty back in the late 80s. And so he was actually a citizen. But I have spoken with people in the same community who were undocumented workers who became sick and continued to go to work because they were afraid not to go. And they wanted to stick it out as long as they could because they were afraid that they wouldn't get paid. It's kind of a patchwork of policies. And some people are reimbursed for time they're off and some people aren't. I talked to one family where the breadwinner was only getting 60% of her pay because they put her on disability.
What have major food producers, or how have they responded to the coronavirus? Are we seeing efforts to provide personal protective equipment for these workers, undocumented or not undocumented?
You know, I think we've seen an improvement in policies, and I was told in Hall County by some of the workers that things had improved. There was more masking, more separation, but these are jobs where people congregate, so it's difficult. Out in the fields, it's a mixed bag. Some farm workers told me that they were getting masks and that they were taking steps, employers to separate people on buses when they're taken out to fields. But others, you see anecdotal evidence that there are people who are still taking great risks and aren't getting protection.
The CDC, which has had its own issues, as we know, in terms of its guidance, in June issued guidance to farm employers for mitigating the spread of COVID-19 in those areas. Has that had any effect on worker health, Susan?
You know, I think there was some evidence in one county in Monterey that's actually tracking people who get COVID by job, by occupation, which really isn't being done nationally, that there was a decline. But they're still getting it. And I would say it's probably not enough. People are still becoming sick. You know, this is a vulnerable population in many cases. We've been living with this denial, you know, that undocumented people and people who may have papers, but their family members don't, are doing this work in many communities across the country at the same time as politicians are attacking them and saying we don't really need them or they shouldn't be here.
You did interview communities that rely heavily on immigrant labor and at the same time say they support President Trump, who has moved to restrict legal and undocumented immigration. So how do those folks feel about what's happening?
You know, that's right. I've talked to people in communities around the country that were Trump voting communities. And people just seem to be in denial, or they simply don't understand the immigration system, and kind of their bottom line is, well, if they want to come work here, they should come legally. People have these, believe in myths, really, that there's some sort of line people can get in to come and do jobs such as these. And there really isn't. There's a guest worker program for farm work only, and very few specialty meat packing like seafood that's seasonal. But the vast majority of these jobs are done by people who live in the country, but they came illegally originally, and some people have been here 20 years, many of them, and or they come as family members. As you say, there is a legal system for entering, but it's really based on family, and President Trump wants to cut back those numbers, too, for family members.
And Susan, finally, in your reporting, you found that there are sort of informal networks that many of these workers have created to care for each other if someone should get sick. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. You know, in a lot of the communities that I where I spoke to people, they have, you know, a professional class of Latinos, and they do try to turn out help for people. They organize food drives. They get churches involved. They get donations from companies, too. But a lot of these workers can't go get cash benefits from organizations that might pay give you some emergency cash to pay rent. So if they don't have papers, they're not going to do that. So people are really reliant now on donations for just basic food if they've lost hours of work. And some workers into the fields did lose hours in the spring in Florida, for example, where a lot of farmers plowed under crops.
Susan Ferris is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, and you can find a link to her report at publicintegrity.org and on our show page. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As we talked about at the top of today's show, Judge Amy Coney Barrett, if confirmed, could be the next Supreme Court justice succeeding Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And though the two women are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, they do have one thing in common, crediting their husbands for supporting them personally and professionally. Here's Barrett at the White House on Saturday.
I couldn't manage this very full life without the unwavering support of my husband, Jesse. At the start of our marriage, I imagined that we would run our household as partners. As it has turned out, Jesse does far more than his share of the work.
Ginsburg was also known for praising her husband, Marty, for his unfailing support.
My first two cancer bouts, Marty stayed with me. He stayed with me in the hospital, sleeping on an uncomfortable couch despite his bad back. And I knew that someone was there who really cared about me and would make sure that things didn't go wrong.
But having a Marty Ginsburg or Jesse Barrett kind of spousal support is rare for many professional women today, and the pandemic has exacerbated that. Despite men spending more time at home since March, domestic responsibilities are still falling disproportionately on women, and that includes everything from doing the housework to teaching the children. In some cases, working women have had to reduce their working hours 4 to 5 times more than their male counterparts. For more on this, I'm joined by Caitlin Collins, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Hello, thanks for the invitation.
And Patty Cohen is an economics correspondent for the New York Times. Patty, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's start with you, Patty. Why is the pandemic disproportionately affecting mothers in heterosexual couples? What's the biggest way it is affecting them?
Well, I think we've got to take one step back and realize that even before the pandemic, there was an incredible imbalance between the work that mothers and fathers do when there are children. Even before that, you have women providing close to 70% of child care, and that's during standard working hours. And so when you think about it now, add on the pandemic. So that burden has been supersized as schools and other activities shut down, everything from cleaning services to babysitters. And so it's just really emphasizing this inequity and imbalance that existed beforehand.
So a lot of things, Patty, at least among potentially upper middle class families, were being outsourced. You mentioned cleaning services and things like that. And now that those things have been taken away, essentially because of the pandemic's restrictions, the burden is still falling on women.
Right. I mean, the burden was always heavier on women, and now it's even more so. And at least in wealthier households or higher income households, it's possible for one income to perhaps cover the expenses in a way that's not possible in lower income households. So they're really hurt there, because not only are we talking about a kind of disparity between the parents, but it's also an income inequality issue, because in those households, you need both incomes really to pay the bills.
Caitlin, do we have any quantitative data that backs up what we're talking about here?
We do. Both before the pandemic and during the pandemic, we have an abundance of evidence, especially beforehand, that shows that women are bearing the disproportionate burden for domestic responsibilities. Patty mentioned childcare and, of course, also housework. Women do roughly 2/3 of the housework and childcare in heterosexual couples in the United States today. And during the pandemic, when we take a look at working hours specifically, it is women and not men who are reducing their working hours. From a study I did earlier this summer, it appears that women in heterosexual married couples with children are reducing their work hours on the order of roughly 2 hours per week. And this has really troubling consequences when we think through the impact of that on women's labor force participation and on their future earnings, their trajectory in the labor market. And without robust policy supports, I fear that this is going to have disastrous consequences for a generation of working moms.
Caitlin, I'm a Gen Xer, and I think I can speak for some of us, maybe not all of us, but there was an assumption that at some point this division would have been erased for our generation, at least to a certain extent. It appears to have been exacerbated instead by this pandemic. But beyond that, as you both mentioned, this is not new. Caitlin, why are men not pulling their weight when it comes to domestic responsibilities?
I will say that men today do more around the house than their fathers did in previous generations, but the additional labor that men are doing at home is primarily in the arena of childcare and not housework. And we have to think of the household as a deeply gendered institution, right? Our ideas about who can and should be doing housework and childcare are differently associated with men and women, right? In general, stereotypical and in many people's opinions, outdated ideals of family life mean that men are thought of as breadwinners and women as homemakers. Of course, that's no longer the reality. Women work nearly on par with men in the paid labor force, yet we haven't seen concurrent change on the part of men's behavior at home in splitting up a more egalitarian division of labor in the domestic sphere. And I think that's because we tend to continue gender stereotyping domestic work as women's responsibility. But of course, men are every bit as capable of housework and childcare as women are today. And it's that behavioral change on the part of men that will really help further equality in the household, and also, of course, its consequences for paid work too.
Patty, we've talked in broad strokes here about people who are in opposite sex couples, but I want to drill down a little bit if we can. Do we know whether this is exacerbated by race? For example, are women of color experiencing more inequity than their white counterparts?
Well, I think that's where you have this overlay of, socioeconomic status and race and ethnicity, because, minority women are disproportionately lower income. And so the burdens on them are that much greater. They're also perhaps more likely to be in jobs that you can't do remotely from home. We see during the pandemic that that's clearly also tends to have a economic factor to it as well. So in all cases, all of these trends that we've been talking about tend to hit minority women even harder.
And I'm wondering, Caitlin, drilling down even further, is there any research that looks at same-sex couples and how the division might be playing out there?
Same-sex couples tend to have a more equal division of labor at home. And I think that gets back to the point I made earlier, which is that when we stereotype these tasks as being associated with men and women in same-sex couples, the gendered dynamic of that is removed to a degree. So research finds consistently that same-sex couples have more equal households than heterosexual couples do.
Turns out that some of our listeners have noticed their relationship dynamics changing in recent months.
Hi, my name is Shiloh Strawbridge. I'm calling from Vista, California. And in the pandemic, I feel like I'm pulling all the weight in the household. Meanwhile, my spouse thinks he's pulling all the weight too. We recognize there's just a lot more weight to be pulled, but we still feel both resentful and grateful we're not doing this alone.
Patty, we sort of opened this talking about, we just heard a caller, sort of building on what we've been talking about, but at the very top, we talked about Jesse Barrett and Marty Ginsburg, two men whose wives went on, at least in Ginsburg's case, to become a Supreme Court justice, the other whose wife is in the running to be a Supreme Court justice, and both of them cited their spousal support as critical to making that happen. Patty, why aren't there more Marty Ginsburgs and Jesse Barretts in the world?
Well, I love the way that you started this part of the segment with that call, which is the mother complaining that her spouse thinks he's doing more. And what's so interesting is that there's a lot of research. In fact, the Times did a poll earlier on, and fathers' perception of the work they were doing was incredibly outsized in proportion to mothers' perception of the work that they were doing. I think it was something like half of the fathers said they were spending more time on it than their spouse, but only 3% of women agreed with that statement. And so, I mean, we're all, in fairness, look, we're all very aware of the time that each person individually that we spend ourselves doing something, and perhaps less aware of it than what your spouse is doing. Perhaps one of the positives of staying home during the pandemic, if you have fathers staying home as well, is that they get to see firsthand a little bit more of just all of the work that's involved, a lot of which seems to get done oftentimes behind the scenes that they're not aware of. But look, it's just what we've been talking about this whole show in terms of the gender roles and discrimination and the assumptions, the cultural biases that are still very prevalent here. And so it is unusual for men to take the dominant role, certainly in terms of all the household responsibilities in addition to childcare.
Speaking of our caller at the top, one of the things that Viola, our caller, said was that they're both resentful about having to do more, but they're also both grateful they're not doing it alone. And Caitlin, I want to ask you about that element here, because not everybody's in a relationship. Not everybody has a spouse to begin with. I mean, I am the sole caretaker for my son since the pandemic started. There are single parents in the world and there are single people in the world. How is all this affecting them?
I think single parents are struggling in a way that heterosexual and even same-sex couples can't comprehend. The idea that you have a partner at home as a both an emotional but also a material source of support day-to-day around the house is invaluable. When we think about how difficult this pandemic has been in terms of the added workload that goes into maintaining a household today, but also the distress and exhaustion, burnout, overwhelm, worry that parents today are feeling. And so single parents in particular who don't have a partner to lean on in the same way that coupled people do, I think we really need to be thinking about how we can better support these folks. The idea that amongst at least professional and white collar workers who are working from home these days are trying to simultaneously care for children because schools and daycares have opened unevenly means that parents are trying to simultaneously care for kids and get their work done. And for those workers who have to go into work every day, I can't even fathom the sorts of patchwork solutions they need to come up with in order to maintain their employment. To me, this really spells disaster for single parents, and we need to do more materially to support them with policy.
As one myself, I will have to say in transparency, I agree with that. Patty, we've started to reopen here, and I think there have been fits and starts as far as like the success of those efforts. But at the end of the day, mostly people are still being very precautious. Most companies are still, you know, a large percent of their workforce are still at home. And it feels like women, it doesn't feel like it, it appears that women are still sacrificing their careers. Why is it that women are the ones to say, you know what, I'll pull back on my career, I'll do less, you know, of this so that I can do more at home? Why do we feel that burden specifically?
Well, I think there's two reasons for it. One, there's differences according oftentimes to income. In upper income households, oftentimes the men will earn more than the woman. So if one person is going to pull back, it may be an economic decision in terms of having the higher income earner, which oftentimes more frequently is the man, take the primary role and have the woman pull back. In lower income families, when oftentimes both members of the couple are earning about the same, again, it's one of those things where culturally just the assumption is and just the habits are of all that women pull back and that women have to take on the added burdens of not only at this point housework and childcare, but even schooling. And a lot of the recent research is showing that, once again, mothers are the ones who predominantly are taking on this role of doing the extra schooling that's filling in now that schools are closed.
Caitlin, you mentioned the extra burden that's falling on single parents in particular, but across the board, I think what's being raised here is really, you know, there's the sort of tongue-in-cheek, where is everybody's Marty Ginsburg question or Jesse Barrett? But there's also the reality that this is a hard thing to be doing right now. What are some policy solutions that you see that could help mitigate some of the stress for parents, whether they're in couples or not in couples?
Look, the U.S. has the most family-hostile public policy of any country in the Western industrialized world. Before the pandemic, parents had no access to things like paid parental leave, high-quality affordable childcare. There's no federal minimum standard for vacation or sick days. And during the pandemic, this means that parents have very little flexibility and caregiving support. And if we think realistically here, our childcare infrastructure is the thing on which every other part of our economy relies. People's ability to work is dependent on their ability to have their kids safe and taken care of while they engage in paid work. And so, to my way of thinking, our federal policies need to be aimed at first reopening schools and daycares as safely as possible before we open things like restaurants, bars, and retail again. It is that basic feature of our economic infrastructure that we have to support safely in order to support working families today. So childcare infrastructure, and then of course giving parents a bit more flexibility when it comes to reducing their hours or taking time, crisis time off, which has been part of the most recent policy package and I think needs to be extended. The ability to have a bit more flexibility is really, really important for working parents today.
Caitlin Collins is an assistant professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. And Patty Cohen is a national economics correspondent for the New York Times. Patty and Caitlin, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And that's all we've got today, folks. We hope you enjoyed the show. It's been a fast-paced news cycle, as you know, but we're going to get through it together. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. And of course, we love hearing from you. So continue to call us about stuff at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-865-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.